Gaston is my favorite song, possibly my favorite like Disney song of all time. It's hilarious. And the lyrics, when they decide they're going to commit Maurice to the asylum to get Belle to marry, the lyrics are, "No one plots like Gaston, takes cheap shots like Gaston. No one plans to persecute harmless crackpots like Gaston." Like, that's perfect. And we lost that because instead it's, "No one plans to, like, tie someone up and leave them to be eaten by wolves like Gaston." Like, that's just not fun.
Hi, and welcome to Episode Cine Nation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Thomas Horton.
And we have no sponsors tonight, like usual.
Oh, I thought we had gotten sponsors since the last time I've been on.
Do we have sponsors? Well, I mean, the de facto sponsor is like Cinephile Video.
Oh, okay.
Located on Sawtelle in Santa Monica in West LA.
That's neat.
44,000 selection. Anyway, they did not pay us at all for that. We're just doing that. So Thomas, what have you been watching recently?
What have I been watching recently? Last night I just watched the pilot of Trial and Error.
Oh, the
John Lithgow show. Yeah, which has been described by several critics as the spiritual follow up to Parks and Rec. So I was really interested.
Okay.
I was also interested because it's a if you haven't seen any of the promotional stuff for it, it's a mockumentary sitcom on NBC about the the trial of a man who's accused of murdering his wife,
mm-hmm.
and played by John Lithgow. But the really interesting thing is it is actually like satirizing a very famous true crime documentary.
Uh-huh.
And it sticks like pretty close to the facts of the case, like tweaks them just a little bit, but a lot less than I thought. Like it's kind of interesting to see like a real murder trial turned into a sitcom.
Yeah.
But they're doing it, so it's interesting. Yeah. So the documentary it's based on is called The Staircase. It's really long, but it's all on YouTube. If you're interested in true crime stuff, it's a pretty interesting true crime documentary. Just one of these things where this guy was accused, his wife had fallen down the stairs and died, mm-hmm. and he was accused of killing her, but they had like the perfect home life. So, but he's still being accused of murder, even though like his kids and it was like a second marriage, and his kids and her kids are all like, this guy didn't do it. Mm-hmm. So this documentary crew comes in, says, we're going to document this whole defense trial. And as they are shooting it, it all starts unraveling, and it comes out like all this dirt comes out on this guy, and his family turns against him, and it's a really interesting documentary. And now it's a pretty funny sitcom so far. I just watched the pilot, but it might be, I've heard The Good Places is also good.
Yeah.
On NBC, I haven't checked it out yet, but but this seems like a step in the right direction for the network, which kind of floundered for a while after Parks and Rec went off the air, I feel like, with their comedy.
Yeah, didn't they at one point after that, or right before that, they stopped doing their like Thursday night comedy block for a
mm-hmm.
little bit?
Yeah.
Because it was after they had lost The Office, they lost 30 Rock, Community, like kind of, they lost those all within like a 3-year period or so, and Parks and Rec. And so they didn't really have, and all their comedies they were releasing just weren't hitting that well.
Yeah.
Because like a lot of one season, like there was, I think Fallon had a show on there at one point, like a sick, like the dad show or whatever that he was producer for. And then what else was there? That Whitney show with Whitney Cummings,
yeah.
I think.
And Undateable.
Undateable. Yeah.
Yeah. Which hung around for a while and built a little bit of a cult following. Was shooting live for the last season, which was really interesting. But yeah, not a big hit, especially not in the kind of, because NBC, when CBS was really starting to build up their like Chuck Lorre, Two and a Half Men, Big Bang Theory reputation, NBC was building a reputation for a little bit more niche comedy that kind of a little bit smarter comedy that appealed to younger audiences and and they kind of lost that. But I think between this and The Good Place, which I really am meaning to check out, I want to watch that. But I think they're really starting to get their momentum back.
And they haven't had, like, besides the like the Law and Orders and the Chicago Fire PD stuff, they haven't really had, like, big show until This Is Us that came out this past year.
Yeah.
That's like a juggernaut for them.
Yeah.
But, like, besides that, they really, comedy-wise and drama-wise, they haven't really had much since most, like, The Office and Parks and Rec went off the air. I'm trying to look at what else they have. They have, currently have that Jennifer Lopez show. Shades of Blue, which got like a third season renewal, and they have Superstore, and The Voice is kind of their big thing. I know, because going to Universal, they had when The Voice is working, everything else is just like kind of shuts down. Like, that's like their big money maker. It's like The Voice and the theme parks. That's where, like, Universal Studios in LA is making their money. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so anything else besides Trial and Error that you've been watching?
We've talked about Legion. Mm-hmm. Oh, I really like no, you know what, I'll save that till the end. So my recommendation also okay. TV based.
I watched a few episodes of Love, the season 2.
Mm-hmm.
Because you and I, we liked the first season. I know you just watched the pilot episode.
I'm a couple episodes in. No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the thing, because we talked about this a little bit with when Barry came on the show, Ben and I. It's kind of difficult when, because Netflix is releasing so much, it's hard to stay in the conversation when there's pretty much a full year gap in between your seasons. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, like, Love's a decent sized show, but it's not like Stranger Things big. And it's like, how do you keep that that audience after a year goes by? Because there's certain shows I watched on Netflix where I watched the first season, like binge watched it so quickly, and then like less than a week, and then they take a year and a half or more to release the new season, and by that point I almost lost interest, and I don't know. And Love's like, it's, I'm not going through it as quickly as I was the first time. It's like I'm having to get back into it after a full year of being away, if that makes sense. And it's because it's, you watch it so quickly, and there hasn't been that kind of water cooler talk about it in a year. Mm-hmm. Because like you and me, I think you and me are the only ones that really watched it out of our group of people, I think. And there wasn't that much like on our Medium, I think we had one person like write about it. It wasn't as big as, say, Westworld or whatever. But I also watched one of the Dave Chappelle comedy specials last night at 3 a.m. in the morning, The Age of Spin, which is the newest one out of the two, because he did one in Austin and then one in L.A. And it's so happy to have him back. Like, I think Dave Chappelle is one of my favorite comedians, if not my favorite comedian. And it's just, he still has the same style of humor. Like, it's like he still knows how to tap dance around certain social issues that you think a comedian couldn't do, and he's able to make it funny. And so I think that'd probably be a recommendation at the end of the show, but I think it's so happy to have him back. So anyway, into the topic for this episode. Mm-hmm. So another thing that Thomas and I watched recently, not together, usually we do, but was Beauty and the Beast, which came out this past weekend. You're listening to it about a week later, and it made $174 million this past weekend,
mm-hmm.
which is an ungodly amount. It's the biggest opening record for March, beating Batman vs. Superman, which Thomas is happy about, I assume.
Yeah.
Biggest
PG opening.
Biggest PG opening, and it's already like almost at $400 million worldwide. Mm-hmm. And the reported number is they had to make like $325 million to break even, and they did that in 3 days, pretty much. So, yeah. So, Thomas, what were your thoughts on the film?
I liked the last third of the movie. That's been my my standard answer. Overall, was not a huge fan of it. Huge fan of the original. Possibly my, not even possibly, definitely my favorite film out of the Disney Renaissance. I love the music. I love the animation. I love the cast of the original. With the new one, and this was the first time I've walked out of, and this is what I felt when after Alice in Wonderland took off and Maleficent was announced, and then Cinderella came along. My initial worry was they're not going to be adding anything to these movies. They're just going to be remaking them in the exact same way, and I'm not. And when you don't add anything of value to it, then all I'm left to do is compare it to the original, and it's more than likely going to pale in comparison. And this was the first movie I felt myself having to do that when I walked out, and in all the rest of them I've seen, I've been able to walk out and say, like, wow, they brought enough to that I, even if they weren't as good as the original, I think Jungle Book's the only one that I really walked out and said that was better than the original. But even if they weren't better than the original, I can still go, like, that felt like a separate, wholesome experience. And this one just felt like a pale representation of what we were given back in the 90s. I can go deeper if you're interested, or you can give your overview and we can go deeper.
I'll give my overview and then we'll go deeper into it. I enjoyed it. I do understand the criticisms that you have completely, and I actually agree with most of them. I guess with me, I just really enjoyed it. I really liked most of the actors involved. There are definitely a good bit of flaws to it, and it does pale in comparison to the original. But I like that they tried certain things on, like, trying to expand the characters. I really like I really love Dan Stevens as the Beast, which a lot of people, he kind of, I feel like not everyone talked about him going into it because Emma Watson was the big person, but I think Dan Stevens is on the same level as her in the film. I think her acting is really great, and there's moments I wish they would have delved into more. I think her singing was a little off. You could tell it was kind of auto-tuned, but I don't know much about all that. I think it was, there was nice stuff in it, but I do think it left me wanting more, which is something that a lot of people, like Sean Randall said in his review, and I think Dan even said when I talked to him about it. There's good stuff in it to me, and I'm interested in actually seeing it again, because the stuff that I really like, I really, really like. And I love Kevin Klein as Maurice as well. Like, there's strong moments to it, and there's strong parts to it, but overall, it's nowhere near as strong as the original. And I think there's certain changes they made from the original they shouldn't have made, but that's my overall view to it.
Yeah. I definitely agree with you, Dan. That's why I say that I like the last third of it, because I really think Dan Stevens is at his strongest.
Yes.
There, and I think Dan Stevens' performance and the script, the writers added to the Beast was the most important thing that this brings to the old one, and that when you go back to watch the original, the appeal of the Beast is like, oh, he was a mean guy, but now he's trying not to be mean, so she should love him. And in this one, he actually has, like, a personality that lines up with hers, and they have common interests, and they have a chemistry that's really great.
Really great.
Yeah, really good chemistry there. But my problem, I wish they had just left the character development to him. Because by going even further to these supporting characters and trying to, like, delve more into their human side, I just felt I mean, they made them more realistic, I'm sure I've spoken on the podcast. I know I've spoken in Medium about how my just, like, insane amount of respect for Kevin Klein as an actor. I absolutely love Kevin Klein, and I think he's got some of the best charisma of anybody that's been on screen in years, but I wasn't feeling it for Maurice. And I've read so many reviews that are like, oh, and Kevin Kline really brings the passion that Maurice has for Belle, and I didn't need a dead mom for that to happen. I honestly feel more for Maurice in the original because he's this eccentric inventor who's like kind of all over the place, and he's fun, and yeah, he's kind of cartoony, but it's a kid's movie, and
yeah,
but he loves his daughter. Like, I don't think the relationship was deepened anymore by making him a more normal person, and I thought it just made his character more mundane. And the same I felt for Gaston. I loved Luke Evans in the role. I thought he had a great voice, and another thing going towards like the strength of the third act.
Yeah.
I thought Kill the Beast was one of the best carryovers. It was one of the best interpretations of the original. But by making him not in, because in the original he's so great because he's this dumb jock who kind of unknowingly turns into this villain. Like, he doesn't mean to be, you know, this awful villain. He's just a dumb jock who has a crush on a girl and thinks that he's, you know, since he's the strongest guy in town, he has a right to, like, marry her, which he obviously doesn't. But by making him so much more sinister in this one, they just lost all the fun of it without adding any more stakes to it. You know, he's still... that's my problem, I think, with all this depth they added to these characters, is by the third act, everyone goes back to the same decisions and actions they made in the original movie, except LeFou.
Uh-huh.
And so the fact that we spent all this time changing their characters only for them to do the exact same thing, I don't know, just didn't work for me. And LeFou, we can have a whole another conversation about what was done with LeFou.
Yeah. No, I think also, too, by making that the biggest, like, the weirdest character jump to me was when we switch from Luke Evans being this kind of, they've made him more realistic and try to make him comical or whatever, but then they just make him complete left turn and just like, I'm going to tie up Maurice. By the way, we're getting into spoilers here, by the way, if anyone didn't realize this. He's going to tie up Maurice and leave him to die. And you're like, wait, what? It just feels like such a sharp turn all of a sudden.
And you lost all of the... See, in the... One of my... Gaston is my favorite song. Possibly my favorite, like, Disney song of all time. It's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the lyrics, when they decide they're going to commit Maurice to the asylum to get Belle to marry, the lyrics are, no one plots like Gaston, takes cheap shots like Gaston. No one plans to persecute harmless crackpots like Gaston. Like, that's perfect. And we lost that because instead it's no one plans to, like, tie someone up and leave them to be eaten by wolves like Gaston. Like, that's just not fun.
and they cut that entire reprise out of the movie. I don't know if they probably didn't shoot it because I don't think they would. They need to because they tie him up with on a tree. I agree with the I love the Dan Stevens character development with the Beast, and I do like some of the stuff with other people. I like that they tried. I do agree. I don't like the whole, I'm okay with the dead mother. I didn't like we spent so much time going into the dead mother, if that makes sense. Like, I didn't like that we needed to have to go to Paris and see her old house and then sing about it. And, like, realize what happened. I go, I feel like you kind of figure that out on your own. Like, she died somewhere along the way. I didn't know if we needed to know all that.
Yeah.
Because that was just one of the songs where when it started, when Emma Watson started singing, I think I audibly go, oh, God, why? Mm-hmm. I'm like, I get all this. We don't need
to. Was that the song when the little kid version of the Beast showed up to sing about his bad dad too? Because hated that song
same,
too.
Same one too. That was when when she puts him to bed, and the servants are telling her about his mother and father, and then it cuts to like little kid watching his mom like die, and you have a, like a brief, like not even a song, it's like a few like verses of like a few lines of singing, and that's it. And we cut back in, and then like on the, him on the bed. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like that moment either. I just didn't, I didn't think we needed either of those. And that's sometimes one of the biggest things I did here, the changes they made that just didn't work, was when they tried to become more musical theater with certain moments. And by that, I mean, for example, when LeFou says the line, "I don't know which monster I've unleashed," or whatever, at the end of it. And I go, why? Just cut to him, and we understand that he realizes, oh shit, I've messed up. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need him to sing that lyric. I think that's more of a, because you can go to a close-up or whatever, like they do in the actual movie. You, on a stage, it's different. You can use him saying that line, because that line is what draws people's attention to him on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
But in film, you can use the camera. And instead, so it just feels weird that he's singing that in the middle of that, when you could just easily use the shot they have and just have LeFou look at Gaston and just have this realization, oh, I don't like the way this is going. And I think they did a few times, like with Emma Watson singing about her dead mother in Paris and all that. I don't think we needed that. Like, if I'm fine with going to that place in a way, but I think that song almost ruined that moment that the Beast and her are having.
Well, and I just didn't think that backstory was necessary for her character. I like that we got a stronger Belle, and that we got more of the, you know, ostracization, because she's smart and she's trying to empower other young girls in the village, yeah. And that's all great. But the dead mom goes along with the deepening of Maurice's character, and that they have a father-daughter relate. The fact that she sacrifices her life to save her dad should be enough to show us that they care a lot for each other.
Yeah. Because she doesn't really do that, and like she sacrificed herself in the original, but the Beast is the one, I think, that takes Maurice and like, he's the one that actually does it.
He agrees to let her swap, whereas in this she tricks both of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a fine move. I like that.
I like it. I really enjoyed it. I agree with you. I think the third act, or really just the latter half of it, when Belle and Beast start to become closer, I think some of the best scenes and the best acting between both of them is when they're like flirting back and forth and like joking with one another and going to the library. I think those are the best moments to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like when she's like, "Was that a joke?" And he's like, "Maybe it was." It's like, it's honest is what made it work so well.
Mm.
And it almost felt, it was taking you out of the whole fantasy element of, oh, this is a girl talking to like a big, huge, hairy beast. And it was still relatable, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I do agree. The other thing is too, that I think it's the most similar remake we had to the original of the Disney live action remakes that I've seen, because Alice in Wonderland I felt was different than the original to some extent. I think Jungle Book was different. I think Cinderella I just watched was really different. It's still kind of the basic Cinderella story, but when you compare it to the original movie, it's still fairly different.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the one.
And that's one where I thought they did the deepening of the villain really well. I thought you really got a sense for the wicked stepmother as opposed to just being evil. You got a lot more of her motivation. Maybe that's where my problem with Gaston is that the wicked stepmother goes back to the old Disney tradition of like this is a villain, this is a bad person. And Gaston by the 90s they knew how to give villains motivation, and so Gaston had plenty of motivation. Yeah. We didn't need his post-war bloodlust to...
You're back in the war.
He
took the blood.
Yeah, he was a hunter, and that's why he, you know, partially he went after the beast because he was a hunter and he wanted the trophy, and then he was also jealous that he saw, you know, some sympathy from Belle for him.
That's a fair point.
But Cinderella is very, very similar storyline, but still feels like a different experience coming out of it.
No, it does. And I think even the look of Cinderella might be better. Because they're able to, even though it's still kind of a fantasy, they're able to hit this realistic, like, approach to the cinematography of it. There's one thing I was thinking of is when you compare the village scenes in Beauty and the Beast to the village scenes in Cinderella, they look vastly different. Like, Cinderella's village scenes look fairly, like, realistic and, like, you're of that time.
Mm-hmm.
Beauty and the Beast sometimes feels more like a larger stage version of that, if that makes sense. It's like, I know they weren't on a soundstage, because I've seen the footage of them actually shooting out in, like, a huge, like, outdoors area, and it looks really, like, it looks great, but when you look at it on film, it still looks like it's soundstagey, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like it was shot on a soundstage, and that's the difference between the two of them to me. But yeah, I think Cinderella brought some new stuff out of it. I think Jungle Book like made more of a cohesive story out of the original animated film. So besides the beast development, were there any other things you liked that they changed from the original to the remake?
I really liked the Beast song Evermore when Belle left. I thought he did a great job with it. I thought it was really cool the way it was shot.
Mm-hmm.
As for the way the rest of it was shot, while we're talking about Cinderella, like I just thought it was kind of dull. The cartoon is so gorgeously animated, and the colors. Like, yeah, she's wearing a yellow dress, but, like, just the colors all around them were just not there. The castle is just... we get that the castle's cursed, but, like, that doesn't mean the whole movie has to be, like, gray.
And that goes into a movie I just watched recently, too. That was the thing I noticed, too, because when I first saw the preview of... At Disneyland, they had, like, a sneak peek of the opening song of Beauty and the Beast. And when I saw it, I go... There's no color in it. It's mm-hmm. all kind of just one color, all in the same color palette. But when you look at the original in that same scene, there's like a lot of dark colors and bright colors. There's a wide variety. And when you look at Cinderella, that's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think because they kind of stay on the same color palette overall, or like similar in tones of color, especially in earlier on in the village stuff, it just felt very bland.
And the with the design, I have a lot of problems with the design of the servants, but the staff. But one of the things being like they're all the same color. Like go back and look at like Lumiere versus Cogsworth versus Mrs. Potts versus Chip versus the dog Footstool. It's like they're all their own characters, and they are all very colorful and different colors. And this one was just like they look like you all bought them at the same place, and they have these very oddly realistic faces that freaked me out, to be honest. I saw Thrillist did an article that was like rating the objects from Beauty and the Beast by how creepy they are. And I was like, 100% like get that. That is.
Yeah.
Like I felt that the whole time. I never felt any warmth toward any of those characters, which are like so endearing in the originals, because the visuals of them were just so alienating. I thought like when we think like, oh, what would a clock look like if it came to life, like we want a little bit of cartoon ish there, like we don't really want to see what a clock would look like if it came to life.
And the same with like Lumiere, who's like wearing clothes as the candelabra. I agree. That's a good point that I didn't think about, was that it's trying to be too realistic in a way. with that. But okay, those are fair points. Because I never thought about it. And it's see, I did enjoy the movie more than you did, I know, from what we're talking about. And it's like, it's more, I recognize the flaws, but for some reason I just still really enjoyed it. And it might be just because I love the original so much, I'm okay with seeing just a little, like, even a mediocre version of it, I'm okay with seeing. And it might just because, too, like with Cinderella, even though I think it's done very, very well, it didn't impact me as much as this one did. And it might be because I've seen a number of Cinderella movies. Hmm. And Beauty and the Beast, there's the French version earlier on, but I don't really see that many rehashes of that story like you might see of Cinderella, or even Alice in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one reason why I felt so attached to it.
Yeah, I guess my main reaction to it was really just like, I'd rather go back and watch the original.
And it's a fair point. And the other thing too that someone commented about was the length of the film. Like, the length of the film is a little over 2 hours long, and the animated version is like 87 minutes long. Like, it's a very tight film, the original.
Mm-hmm.
I
would have been, there's a subreddit called Fixing Movies where you go, uh-huh, like, oh, blah, blah, blah. I would have been much happier with the film if the second two acts, alright, I'll give you this. I would have been just much happier with the film in general if the first act had been pared way down, mm-hmm, and the second two acts had been handed to me exactly the way that they were. It took too long to get Belle to the castle.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And we were just given too much development on characters that weren't as necessary.
That's fair. So after the, cause going into the, off of the, our thoughts on Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, wait. I want to do my LeFou bit really quick.
I do your LeFou bit.
I've been thinking a lot about LeFou because he was one of my favorite characters in the original.
Yeah.
I loved when they cast Josh Gad. I was so excited. I thought he was like the perfect choice.
Uh-huh.
But they made a huge change in his character. And it's not the one that you saw in the news. They changed him. If you go back, the original LeFou is a physically comedic character. And they cut all of the physical comedy and made him a sarcastic character, which also the original LeFou has, like, doesn't have a sarcastic bone in his body.
No.
And I understand that, like, you can't bring that physical comedy of shoving a tuba into his head and having his lips come out the end of it.
Yeah.
Like, it's real life. But Josh Gad is a very physical comedian. I've seen him do physical comedy and I just did not care for it. And I have a strong history with Stephen Chbosky. I just didn't care for the jokes that were written for him. I didn't think they were very funny. It felt like it was one of those when you're sitting in the audience, you go like, huh, that was supposed to be funny. Like, I'm supposed to laugh here. I know I'm supposed to laugh here.
Yeah.
But even there's one thing that they felt the need to change, I guess because the way that they've changed LeFou's character, but like, it felt so unnecessary and such a huge step down. If you look at it like from as a student of comedy, in the original version of Gaston, when he gets to the big finale and he can't spell Gaston and he goes G G A S G A S T G A S T O and you realize that he has no idea how to spell this guy's name and he's struggling and he's panicking and then he just ends the song. That's hilarious. What's not hilarious is I just realized I'm illiterate and I don't know how to spell. That's when we talk about jokes, when we talk about storytelling, everyone always says show don't tell. And that's telling and not showing. And that I think that highlights the way these jokes were, and it goes to, I hadn't picked up on that, but what you said also for his line during Kill the Beast is whoever wrote for LeFou really, really did not have a very high amount of respect for the intelligence of the audience. And I mean, the fact the fact that they scrapped a joke from, and I know that most audiences are kids.
Yeah.
So the fact that they scrapped a joke that worked for kids. I used to love when I was a kid that LeFou couldn't spell Gaston's name. But the fact that they scrapped a joke, they dumbed down a joke that was like successful for kids in the 90s. That kind of thing just felt a little cheap.
I agree with that, because that was the same thing I thought when I heard it. I was like, that's not, we don't need to hear that. Like, we could get that with saying G-A-S-O-T.
And the same thing, like you said, cut into, you know, kind of a close-up and show him, like, sweating it out. Let's just show him searching for the letters, and we go, boom. We've already talked about how nobody knows how to read in this village other than Belle. Like, boom. Yeah. This guy's an idiot, too. He doesn't know how to spell. Instead, him saying the word illiterate made me feel less, you know, I didn't even believe he was illiterate, that he knew the word illiterate. Because
he knew the word illiterate, exactly. Yeah. I was like, that doesn't make any sense. And that's kind of a change to the original song, which I didn't always, because I changed the lyrics a few times in a couple of these songs, and just because I love Howard Ashman's original lyrics so much, I don't know why you need to change any of them, because Ashman was so good at not just lyrics with his songs, but also storytelling. Mm-hmm. So, like, he didn't have that LeFou line in there. He didn't have, the LeFou line at the end and Kill the Beast. He didn't have LeFou saying he was literate. That was all, like, he didn't have to spell it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did that a couple times, even in the new songs, like when the song in Paris that I keep going back to. I feel like the opening line is like, when my mother died. I'm like, we get that. We've established this in what we're seeing. I think that was one of the biggest things wrong with when it came to the lyrics of it. And see, I don't know if the LeFou stuff is either in the lyrics or in the script writer. That's the...
Yeah,
the
well, I mean, back. I think it translates to the character they decided to build for him, I just think was really mixed up in that they didn't know... I mean, LeFou is the fool in French.
Yeah.
And they kind of decided to make him smarter than Gaston, but they didn't fully commit to it all the way because they wanted to keep some of the jokes from, like, the original.
Yeah, there was...
Like, the LeFou they built always had, like, the way this LeFou works is, like, Gaston says something dumb, he walks away, and then LeFou says something smart after he leaves.
Yeah.
If that's the case, like, just cut the joke altogether where he doesn't know how to spell Gaston, because that just doesn't fit in with this character that they've built.
Exactly. And there was, like, oh, it's like when he, at the beginning, because I remember watching this and a friend pointed out, when he's like, je ne sais quoi, when LeFou says that, and Gaston says, I don't know what that means. And my friend goes, but it's French.
Yeah.
And you're in France.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you not know what that means?
The one-liners that were inserted into this film were just real weak. Really, really weak.
Yeah. And like, I remember, I feel like Bill Condon said that, like, LeFou was supposed to be kind of, and this is weird to say it, but, like, kind of the audience's perspective is what he said. I think this is what he said. I can't find the interview. Like, that's what, he's saying what the audience wish they could say. Like, when he's like, never gonna happen, ladies. When the girls are, like, obsessed with Gaston. Mm-hmm. I think that was a key character they did kind of mess up. And I don't know if it was because Josh Gad was in it and they wanted to give him a smarter role. I don't know what it had to deal with. And that kind of comment goes off my next question, kind of going off of the Disney live action stuff, is how important is it that you have stars or recognizable faces in these roles? In the live action stuff, because, like, with Cinderella, Lily James is not that.
Yeah, and I thought she was great. But then
you have Emma Watson.
But then you have the kid in Jungle Book.
I think it's
cool to see Emma Watson be Belle. Like, that's cool.
Yeah.
It's also cool. I like kind of what they'd done earlier with Even if you go back to like the first Alice in Wonderland, like Mia Wasikowska was not a household name. Isn't necessarily. Still isn't.
Yeah.
But I was a big fan of her going into that one. But but you surround them with interesting people, and like in Cinderella, you've got this fresh-faced young girl coming off of Downton Abbey who's gonna be Cinderella. That's cool. She looks great. Then you've got Cate Blanchett is gonna be the evil stepmother, and Helena Bonham Carter and Richard Madden fresh off of Game of Thrones. Like, and then Jungle Book was the same way. Cast this kid nobody, absolutely no one knows, but surround him with these really talented voice actors. Like, and that, you know, that's the way Disney functioned in the Renaissance. Was you cast people who had really good singing talent, or sometimes you had them double up, and had somebody else do the singing voice. But anyway, like the people playing the main characters usually weren't very well known. It was the genies and that sort of thing, and the Lumieres and the Cogsworths, Mrs. Potts, that were the star power. And I think that helped in building these characters as very singular characters, you know, like Aladdin is Aladdin, because it wasn't, you know, I don't know who could have played Aladdin at that point, but
yeah,
you know what I'm saying? They were usually Broadway talents at that point. I will say, I really, as much as I enjoyed Emma Watson's performance, like you said, the singing was kind of rough.
Yeah.
And I think if this is a path they continue to go down, my roommate actually said they might have to consider going back to like dubbing other people's voices into it, which I don't know how people would feel about that. But that's a conundrum. It's like, do you flex your star power and like force people to sing when they're not very good singers, or do you go for people who have really good voices and find the untapped talent?
Yeah. Well, the other thing is it's not saying she has a bad voice. I don't think that. It's just, is her voice right for this role?
Right. Right.
That's the big thing. It's like, because with this one, you kind of have to be damn near perfect to hit the notes and stuff in these songs. It could be a different musical and she'd be completely fine. Like, I mean, like Woody Allen did a musical in the early 90s where he's like, I don't really want phenomenal singers here. I just want people who can, like, are great actors who can somehow carry a tune.
Right.
I think one thing with casting her, I don't think personally Beauty and the Beast would have been as successful in its opening weekend if Emma Watson was not in it.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Because I mentioned this in the last episode when I talked with Larry, and I've talked about before, was I read a script for someone, and I told them, they asked me who I thought, who should be the lead female star, and I was like, well, Jennifer Lawrence is like the go-to because of this character is in her like wheelhouse, but like she kind of already played this before. If you want to go against type, go Emma Watson. And they go, well, she's just not really a big star, is she? And I go, you'll find out with Beauty and the Beast. Because this is like about 5 months before Beauty and the Beast came out. And I think Beauty and the Beast kind of showed Hollywood that she is actually a star. She's not just Hermione from Harry Potter.
Yeah.
It's like, I know on the Deadline article I sent you, it talks about how like it became, the Beauty and the Beast trailer became like the fastest watched trailer ever of all time, with like 90 million views in one day, and 40 million of that came from her social media, like people clicking the link on her social media. That's freaking insane.
Yeah, because like, she's been a personality who's really built up a presence, as in her outreach and her you know, her speeches and her political support. She's someone who, I mean, obviously has grown up, a lot of people grew up with her, was part of a major franchise, but and then kind of took some time off, but has continued to keep a very major public presence throughout. Because so she's definitely, you know, we talked about, and you guys did an episode about, like, whether the movie star exists, but she's definitely, I think, a celebrity who can definitely draw in audiences and fans.
Yeah, I think a big test will be her next film, The Circle, with Tom Hanks, because you have two big stars there, and the big question is, will STX, who's distributing it, capitalize on her now big stardom?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, for example, my mother might go to a movie two or three times a year if she's lucky. Like, she rarely goes to the movie theater. She doesn't really like going to our specific movie theater, and it depends on who's in the movie. And, like, she actually went to see Beauty and the Beast by herself to go watch it. Usually she goes with my dad. And she loves the original movie, but literally all she was saying was, like, I really want to see her in this, Emma Watson in this movie. Mm. And my mother she's not on social media, like, she's not on Emma Watson's Twitter or whatever. She doesn't really know what Emma Watson's doing outside of movies. She's like, I want to go see her because I really, really like her. And she went, like, opening weekend. And I'm like, that's a big deal, because and I think that's a lot of people, is that someone like her brought people into the movies. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just Beauty and the Beast. I mean, like, when you compare Beauty and the Beast record or opening weekend to the other live action movies they did were big, but nowhere near as big as this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So the next question I have is, what do you think Disney should do now after this? Because they're talking, like, after Beauty and the Beast was released, they're, like, doubling down with, like, we have 29 movies in the works for a live-action remake.
I just think this is the first one they've done where this won't translate to everyone, this is film nerdy, but this is the first one they've done where I wasn't very interested in anyone behind the camera. And I think that showed in the quality of the film.
Yeah,
they've done, as we talked about in the past, they've been doing with these live action films what Marvel's been doing, you know, everyone's been doing lately, is you either take somebody who's brand new, like they did with Peach Dragon, or you take somebody who's really established with an interesting vision, like Kenneth Branagh or Jon Favreau,
or even Tim Burton.
Especially Tim Burton. I mean, that was a major part. That was the whole appeal of Alice in Wonderland, is, like, what does Tim Burton bring to this? I think that's the key. I think Bill Condon was just too safe of a choice.
Yeah.
Like what would Damien Chazelle directing Beauty and the Beast look like, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm encouraged by the choices they've been making so far for these for the ones they have announced.
Yeah, like Aladdin with Guy Ritchie, I know, is probably
that's
like,
gonna be interesting. I have been a big Guy Ritchie fan. I am falling out of it a little bit I think he's losing a lot more of his style as he makes more and more stuff. Like, I didn't even know that the King Arthur movie was directed by him until 2 weeks ago. But I think it'll be different. And that's the key, is, like, when you're doing these, you just don't play it so safe. Yeah. Give me a reason why this should exist, why I should spend, you know, freaking $20 if you're going to see a movie in LA.
Yeah.
When I could just pop in the DVD of Aladdin.
Yeah.
At home.
One thing I read that Guy Ritchie, or someone was talking about, that's high up at Disney, about Guy Ritchie being the one for Aladdin. He was like, well, all of Guy Ritchie's early movies are about street hustlers. And that's what Aladdin is.
Yeah. Go, yeah.
Oh God, that's amazing.
Yeah. And criminals, lovable criminals. That's Lock, Stock and Snatch. Like, yeah.
I was like, if you do that, that's a really interesting idea.
Yeah.
I think, and there, I know they have, like, they have Tim Burton on Dumbo.
Mm-hmm.
Who do they have on Mulan? They have someone on Mulan that just came out recently and said there would be no music in the movie.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I was fine with in Cinderella.
Yeah. But That's one thing, because in the article on Deadline, Sean Bailey, who is, what is he? He is the president of Walt Disney Studio Pictures, I believe. He's one of the top guys. We'll put it in the show notes.
Their live action division.
Their live action division. In the article with Sean Bailey, they talked about how Beauty and the Beast originally wasn't going to be a musical. Like, they wanted to take away the music and just make it like Cinderella, just a straight story. And they decided to like own the Disney brand to it and put the music back in there. And I was fine with that. I think Beauty and the Beast music is so well known, you kind of had to do that. Cinderella, or let me rephrase, because the music was so inherent to the story, because I think that's because of Howard Ashman, who wrote the lyrics of it, who I talk about on Medium on one of my recent articles. I think because he was so involved with story, I think you needed those music in it. I'll be interested to see what they do with Little Mermaid, because
assuming they keep the music in because Lin-Manuel Miranda is attached.
Yeah, so. He is. But the question is, will they be writing a whole bunch of new songs or what? I mean, there's a reason with Howard Ashman, who wrote the lyrics. There's a reason why a lot of the most recent like Disney musicals on Broadway come from that Disney Renaissance era. Like, you don't see many from before. It's because you had someone like Ashman, who is from the theater, and Menken as well, who brought in that style to Disney. So you had like Little Mermaid on Broadway. You had Beauty and the Beast that ran for a long time. You have Aladdin currently on Broadway. And then Lion King, even though he didn't work on it, you have some like Elton John. It's in the music, and that's inherent to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And as they got older, I don't think music wasn't as inherent to the story. So I don't know. Think it's needed as much in Mulan, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and I mean, I would honestly be surprised if they left it in Dumbo. Maybe like in a Jungle Book type way, where you know you could have somebody sing Elephant Cry or Elephant Fly, but like you know, just not a big musical number, just somebody sings it.
Yeah.
But with Mulan, I think you've got to think about when you're making these adaptations. You got to think about. And this is something they didn't do for Beauty and the Beast. And I think it's fine because Beauty and the Beast is so iconic. But when you're making these live action adaptations, you got to think about what type of movie does this want to be, especially when you bring it over to live action. And Mulan is a war movie.
Yeah.
And if you're making a live action war movie, usually people aren't going to stop and sing. That makes sense as a creative choice, and I'm totally on board with it. And they'll probably do like they did with Cinderella, and have somebody come in and sing "I'll Make a Man Out of You" and play it over the credits. So you'll still get like a cool new cover.
Yeah.
But it's not super necessary for the story they're trying to tell, which I think that's the main thing. Is just like keep an eye on the story, keep that in mind. How can you tell this story best? And that's what was so good about Jungle Book, was because they said, how can we best tell this story? And that was by threading the narrative together, bringing in Shere Khan earlier, establishing a sense of like urgency, bringing the stakes up, and it made for a much more exciting and more interesting film than the original. Yeah.
And going off that, and then your earlier comment about directors, how you really weren't excited for Bill Condon. Bill Condon has a great resume, but
he's Breaking Dawn, Part One.
Well, Dreamgirls. Let me rephrase. He has a very mainstream resume, where it's like if you make a box office since like if you have a box office hit in the industry, you're gonna get another job, and it's gonna be probably on the same level as your last film or bigger. But he's kind of, I hate to say this to him, but I think when you're talking about musicals, I think Dreamgirls is a much better movie as a musical than this one was. But this one, there wasn't a lot of risk involved in it, is the big thing. And so I know, like you talked about how it was Jon Favreau. I think he took it a risky thing of like, you know, we're in this entire movie with just a kid on a green screen and everything else is going to be CGI. That's a big kind of risk, and I think it paid off.
Well, and I think the choice somebody made, and I don't know whether it's when, I'm sure this was kicked around when they had the script to Cinderella, somebody said, what is this movie? Not just, you know, is this a remake of Cinderella? Somebody said, what is this movie?
Yeah.
This is a costume romance. Who does period romances? Oh, Kenneth Branagh's directed like every Shakespeare adaptation that there is. Let's get him. And that's what he brought to it, was this style that was costume romances, not a Disney style, not a musical style, not a fairy tale style, but a you know, costume romance.
Yeah, and that's thing, like, I mentioned, because Bailey talked about how, what do you say? Because they asked, or he says, while a live-action Fantasia would seem daunting, Bailey said no animated property is off the table if a filmmaker can find a way in. Which means, I think they're open to, I mean, like, for example, when we haven't really mentioned that much, was Maleficent. The director of that, that was his first time directing a movie, was Maleficent, Robert Stromberg. He was like a CGI, like a post-production or a CGI supervisor on let's see, what did he do? On Oz the Great and Powerful, Avatar, and Alice in Wonderland. So he knows, like, kind of the Disney way. And he was a special effects artist and art decorator. He won two Oscars, one for Oz and one for Alice in Wonderland. And that was his first movie he directed. And I think that was a risk for Disney to give a first-time filmmaker Maleficent. Mm-hmm. And it was a $180 million budget, production budget for that. I mean, there has to be a little risk in there. Even though, like, Beauty and the Beast was, like, the most expensive musical of all time, it just, it wasn't as risky as it could be. I think some of the other, the upcoming ones, I think Aladdin is kind of risky. I mean, because I guess putting Guy Ritchie in a big, huge Disney film just looks kind of weird. And, like, you kind of want to see that movie just because of that.
And that's the thing I have to hand to Guy Ritchie, and he's one of those people, kind of like I've talked about Gore Verbinski, like, I'm always down to watch a Gore Verbinski film.
Yeah.
Because Guy Ritchie keeps, he doesn't, he loses his, I would say he lets studios, like, take his edge, but he doesn't let him take his style. Even Man from U.N.C.L.E. was stylish and had some really interesting shots where you go, oh, that's Guy Ritchie. So I think, you know, and I honestly believe Disney, from what I've seen from some of their other directors they've been working with, I think they have a much more creative, they build a better creative environment for their directors. So I think he'll bring something really interesting to it. And that's all I'm asking for is, you know, make it a different experience, because when you make it just the exact same experience, all I'm going to be thinking about is how the original was better.
Yeah. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do, and also just what Disney live action does in general. Because they are, Sean Bailey talked about in the article how, even though, like, our names on the thing when you walk in Walt Disney Studio Motion Pictures or whatever, but he is, we were never, like, a really an asset. Like, the assets were, like, Marvel, Lucasfilm, Pixar. Those were, like, the big money makers. No one really saw Disney live action as that big of a thing. And I think, my worry is that they're going to spend too much time on the live action remakes and we fall into just carbon copies of the animated films. That's my big worry. But the also the thing that you talked about was with Emma Watson being so big in this, are we going to start seeing more stars in these roles? I don't know, because the big thing, because I think Disney realizes that their property is the star, which is kind of what's becoming the whole studio thing in general. Because I know with Dumbo, like, at one point, Dumbo was supposed to star Tom Hanks and Will Smith, which sounds crazy to me. But they allegedly, or one of the reasons why Smith is not in the movie is because it was like, he was asking for like $20 million or whatever. And Emma Watson's only made $3 million when she first signed, and possibly $15 million because of the box office gross. they're fine with not signing big stars. It'll be interesting to see what they do next, because 29 movies in development just for live action remakes is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, will there be room for anything else coming out of there?
Mm-hmm.
Because then, will we get more Disney theme park based attraction or films like Pirates? I know that they put on the article that they still have like Jungle Cruise with The Rock.
They still have the Del Toro Haunted Mansion with Ryan Gosling down on their slate. Last time I looked, that's still gestating too. So
it's Disney, so I think they know what they're doing mostly. I think they have just a library and archive of property and brand, like and brands that they don't have to, like, they're fine with. They can release a movie and bomb. If it was any other studio that released Lone Ranger, let's see, what was it? John Carter, Lone Ranger, Tomorrowland within a 4-year period, and they all lost like over at least $200 million to the company, other people would be worried. Other studios would be worried, but Disney somehow just doesn't have to worry about that.
No. They can absorb. They can swallow anything.
Yeah, because they're the guys to beat, and it's going to be so difficult. And one thing I found interesting in Sean Bailey's article, which is kind of a switch from what it was like 7 years ago before they bought Marvel and Lucasfilm, was Disney was kind of known to be like, they're releasing films targeted towards like girls and young girls or the female demographic, and they need more of a male demographic. So that's why I bought Lucasfilm and Marvel. And then, like, now they're saying they didn't really have the female demographic, which I find very interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what Beauty and the Beast filled most recently. Like I said, we could delve into Disney company as a whole because they just have so much stuff going on. But, yeah, so what live-action film are you most interested in seeing in the future from them that they've announced? Is it still Aladdin or is it a different one?
Ooh, I'm really interested to see this, like, Mary Poppins sequel they've got coming up. It's a great cast.
Yep.
Also the Peter Pan with David Lowery. Yeah. I think he's a very interesting director. I still haven't seen Peach Dragon, but I like a lot of his indie stuff, and I like the idea that he's a director who's kind of going back and forth between he came after Pete's Dragon before Peter Pan. He went and directed the latest film, came out at Sundance this past year, and I've been told it's his best work yet. Yeah. So yeah, I'm a big fan of people like that doing stuff. But yeah, probably most excited for this Mary Poppins thing because it's a risk. It's something different. It's a story. Yeah. I can get really excited for this because it's a story I don't know. So I feel like I know I've come off on this whole episode like I hate these, but I think I texted you after I got out of Jungle Book. I was like, I want to be mad at Disney for just recycling these movies.
Yeah, you did.
But as long as they keep doing it this well, I can't get mad.
Yeah.
And so like Beauty and the Beast kind of broke that seal for me, but hopefully they continue. Like up until Beauty and the Beast, I absolutely loved all the remakes they had done so far and was thoroughly impressed with them. So and I didn't hate Beauty and the Beast, I just wasn't blown away by it.
Yeah.
And so I really hope they kind of can get back, especially I just think Beauty and the Beast is such a beloved property.
Yeah.
That they I think it was kind of a burden on them to try and create something new but not. And so hopefully when you get into like older properties that millennials don't know as well, you get a little more leeway with like Lion King, since it's basically going to be animated. Like John Favreau gets a lot of leeway on that one.
Yeah.
Even though it's live action, it's animated. I think I have hope for the future. I'm not just, you know, poo-pooing all this stuff, but we'll see.
And I'm interested too. Mary Poppins Returns, I'm interested in. And it's, when you get to the older stuff, that'll be interesting, like you say, of like how much leeway do they have. I know they're doing a 101 Dalmatians spinoff called Cruella.
Mm-hmm.
That's Emma Stone. But that could be taking the whole Maleficent route, which will be interesting if that's what they do. And then they're doing... It wasn't an animated film, but they're remaking 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And James Mangold, who just did Logan, is attached to it. So that could be an interesting film. The other question I was going to ask, too, it's not really a question, it's more of just a statement, is that now, with because they're doing these, they're releasing these live-action remakes, they don't really have the ability to make sequels of them, which mm-hmm. is kind of against what Disney's been doing with, like, Star Wars and Marvel. This is kind of the first time they're, like, doing kind of... It's like Disney live-action remakes are basically a franchise in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, and I find it interesting to see what they're going to do, because there's Disney wanted a Jungle Book 2, but Favreau's like, no, I want to do something else instead. And we've seen what happens when they do a sequel with Alice in Wonderland 2, where it doesn't do as well. And so the question is, like, should they try to find a sequel for stuff, because, like, they're talking about doing a sequel for Maleficent, or should they just leave it as it is and mm-hmm. just, like, do the one-offs and move on? I'm not sure.
Yeah, me neither. I don't know. I can't advise them in that one.
Anyway, they're gonna be making a lot of money regardless. So yeah. But anyway, so that's the end of that topic. We'll probably talk more about Beauty and the Beast in the future. I know, I'll be doing an episode in the future with one of our listeners, Sean Randall, who's also one of our writers, on musicals. So Sean, be very excited. I just announced it on the show when you're listening to this. But so, Thomas, what are your recommendations for this week?
The other recommendation I was going to make is Crashing on HBO.
Oh, Pete Holmes?
Yeah, I've been a big fan of Pete Holmes for a very, very, very long time. Even prior to, like, I've been a fan of Pete Holmes long enough to have been excited when it was announced he was getting his own late night talk show. Which was very shortly lived, but I watched almost every episode of it.
That was on TBS, right?
It was on TBS after Conan. Pete Holmes has such an interesting voice in comedy, especially today, because he's, like, such an optimist and he's so cheerful all the time, and so it's such an interesting twist on that tired old, like. I hate saying tired old. Like, I love, like, Louis.
Yeah.
Even going back to, like, Seinfeld, kind of, but just, like, what's the day in the life of a comedian? Like, we've seen that story. So now it's, like, so Crashing is this guy who was, like, kind of trying to be a stand-up comedian, but didn't really fit into the lifestyle. So he, like, lived out in the suburbs with his wife. He's a former youth minister. He's, like, very buttoned up and really... kind of friendly, optimistic guy, and he drives into New York every night to, like, do a stand-up and then drive home to be with his wife. Goes through a divorce, gets kicked out of his house, and kind of ends up having to be thrown into this world of, like, New York stand-up that we know from things like Louis.
Yeah.
And it's just seeing this person who is so completely not fit for that lifestyle try to navigate it. Is a really interesting spin on this character, on this, like, storyline that we kind of know. So it's a lot of fun. I love seeing Pete Holmes kind of interact with and kind of the way it's set up. It's called Crashing because he, like, will meet these more famous comedians playing versions of themselves.
Yeah,
and will crash on their couch. So, like, T.J. Miller is playing a version of himself. Artie Lang is in the first two episodes. So yeah, it's like Louis, except a lot more cheerful, and it's still it's still pretty dark. Like, things are definitely not working out for this guy. He's homeless in New York, but he has this level of optimism that I find really refreshing throughout, and it's well worth a watch.
Yeah, I've heard good things, so I need to check it out. How many episodes has it been so far?
I think they're on, like, six. It's on Sunday nights. Yep.
Okay, which is all HBO stuff. Yeah, my recommendation, I'll just say what I said earlier, is Dave Chappelle stand-ups on Netflix. specifically Age of Spin, because that's the most, I think, I haven't seen Austin City Limits, but I've heard that one's not as relevant for today as Age of Spin is. Because, but yeah, I think check out anything he's done on Netflix. I think he's releasing a new one that he's recorded post-Trump sometime in the future. That's like the bigger one that they're, I think he's either, he's already done it or he's about to do that stand up, but Age of Spin's really good. It's so weird because he was recording it in the middle of the whole OJ Simpson, like AMC show, Ryan Murphy show. And mm-hmm. so like he kind of does it throughout, but he bases his entire stand up in a way around the four times he met O.J. Simpson in his life. It's so funny that he kind of based it all around that while also dealing with things like Bill Cosby and his show, the Chappelle show, and all these different things. I mean, when I get off here, I'm going to listen to the other one that he did. If you love comedy and Netflix just hitting it out of the park, I think these stand-up specials they're picking up. I mean... HBO used to be the home for stand-up comedy, but feels like Netflix is becoming that's one of their big banners. It's just mm-hmm. where all the stand-up comedies want to. I mean, like, Amy Schumer was one of the last big ones due to HBO, and now she just did her recent one through Netflix. And it felt like she kind of fell by the wayside because they have so many big people on Netflix now. Like, when Chappelle's doing a $60 million deal and Chris Rock's doing a $50 million deal, it's hard to compete with that, unless you're Kevin Hart. and he makes some good Kevin Hart jokes, and that one is an Age of Spin. So, but yeah, that's our episode. Make sure you follow us on iTunes or subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a rating, write us a review. That's how people find us, and we'd like to hear your feedback to hopefully get better at this, what we're doing. Also, make sure you like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Cinenation Show. And follow or look at our stuff on Medium. We have a lot of great stuff coming out, usually almost daily now. If you want to be a writer, we'd love to look at your stuff. I know Thomas had, what was your last article you did?
The last one I wrote was probably the one about our experience working on Breakdown.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a little short one about working on a micro budget film we made.
Yeah. And so hopefully we can get more of like filmmaking stuff like that, because that was a fun article to read. But yeah, Thomas, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, man, thanks for having me
late in the evening for this one. And guys, thank you for listening. Hope you listen to more episodes soon. Bye.